Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, the Woj Pod. Get the inside scoop on all the biggest NBA news as the biggest names in the game join ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski for the Woj Pod, featuring in-depth conversations, breaking news, reaction, and analysis, and coverage of the biggest events on the NBA calendar, as well as an occasional deep dive into some of the most notable events in NBA history. The playoffs are starting up here quickly, so be sure to check it out. Follow the Woj Pod as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about something interesting going on in the college sports landscape with paying players, kind of. And we'll also have our latest installment of The Right Time Book Club. Joel Anderson of Slate will be on with us to talk about Kane Mutiny by Bruce Feldman. But first, all right, so I have discussed on here how this NBA season has just been a little bit short on excitement, right? It just hadn't really snatched us up by the chest and really gotten us into it. There's all kinds of theories and explanations as to why it is. I do find, though, one thing that we have learned, I typically feel like fans think that they are a little bit too damn important and that we're supposed to care a little bit too much about how they feel and what they do and the likes, comma, however, it sure would be a lot better if y'all were in the arenas. Like, I don't necessarily know how safe it'll be to be out here with 20,000 people in a place, but having 20,000 people in a place does help a whole lot in terms of like what the feeling is on this show. It's almost like we didn't fully realize it, but the sports are a television show that's meant to have a laugh track, right? Like, if you watch a show that is written for a laugh track, you could tell it doesn't hit if the laugh track is not there in the background. Some things are really funny, but it's not built for the laugh track and you don't need it, right? No, we need the studio audience in the house. We need to kind of have that feeling every now and then of what it is, the ups and downs of the emotion and not liking calls and all that stuff. You know, like, I think that that's a part of it. But the NBA put in this play-in tournament this year. And if you're not familiar with the play-in tournament, you probably heard about it. I just want to make sure that you know how the play-in tournament works, because I had a bit of a misunderstanding about this before. My assumption was going to be that the 7 through 10 seeds were going to be in the playoff tournament, and then the 7 seed would play the 10 seed, the 8 seed would play the 9 seed. You know, that's normally how that goes when you break up the brackets. No, the way it's going to work is the 7 seed plays the 8 seed, and the 9 seed plays the 10 seed. So the winner of the game between the 7th seed and the 8th seed gets the 7th seed in the playoffs, right? The loser between the 9th seed and the 10th seed is eliminated from the tournament. And then the loser of the 7-8 game will play against the winner of the 9-10 game. And then that team will wind up being the 8th seed in the tournament, okay? So let's take a look on if the season today ended today, what would the play-in games look like? In the East, we would have Boston versus Charlotte in the 7-8 game, the Wizards versus the Pacers in the 9-10 game. In the West, we would have the Lakers and the Warriors in the 7-8 game, and the Grizzlies and the Spurs in the 9-10 game. Now look, when they came up with this idea for this damn play-in tournament, I thought it was just going to wind up being an artificial contrivance. Like, I was just kind of like, you know, do we really need these tricks in order to get this thing going? Okay, now, you remember what I told you about how the pairings and the games work out, right? So what we're going to have here in the East is Boston and Charlotte playing for a playoff seed and to get into the playoffs. And then the Wizards and the Pacers, man, they ain't got no business in the damn playoffs. But, you know, I guess it's cute that they kind of have a chance. But in the West, again, if the season ended today, we would have Steph versus LeBron in them, and the winner gets in. The loser is then in a one-game elimination playing for their seasons. Can you imagine the tension that will result if the Lakers got caught in a one-game scenario to make the playoffs? And when I talk about the tension, I'm talking about that tension on Park Avenue. I'm talking about that tension for the league. They got to be shook. I would be shook. Like, you know, you'd like to have Steph. Okay, I mean, that would be nifty. That would be cool. But you know, built this damn league on LeBron for the last 15 years, and they might play themselves out of the playoff. Woo! That'll be bad. Like, you might be looking at it, and you might be saying to yourself, well, you know, at least the Clippers are still in L.A. Yeah, yeah, they in L.A., but they not L.A. Like, that ain't going to really get you no big television ratings out of Los. Oh, no. This thing has worked. Like, I think they wound up with some some things happening with this play-in tournament that one would not expect. None of us would have expected that it would be Lakers-Warriors potentially playing against each other. I think the Warriors were much more of a possibility, you know, given all the Klay Thompson stuff and the corpse of Draymond Green and them bums that Steph is out there playing with, right? Like, this is not terribly out of the realm of possibility that we would have wound up in this place. But the Lakers? Like, the injuries and everything took them down there. Did we ever think that you would wind up with the Celtics at the seventh seed? I watched them get their doors blown off by the Heat. Like, that game wound up getting a little closer by the time it was done, but they were down like 26 points or something, you know, after a point in that game. But they got teams in this play-in tournament that you actually want to watch. I don't know how much that's going to happen down the line in most years, but they've got legitimate marquee matchups. Like, that one in the East, if it's Boston, that's the 7-5. If it's not Boston, it'll be Miami, which is possible. Like, it could shake out that way. But either way it goes, it's them versus LaMelo Ball. Now, if LaMelo Ball was introducing himself to America via a four-game playoff series, that wouldn't really work. And the reason it really wouldn't work is they're going to get swept. You know, like, I don't think anybody would be really that charged up about watching them get swept. But playing a team of a similar level with some stakes in a one-game matchup, I'm in. I'm all the way in. And the more I think about this play-in tournament, another thing that I think is ultimately going to prove to be helpful, and we don't really have that so much this year with the matchups that we're talking about, but something that I think is ultimately going to prove helpful is give some young teams a chance to play for something, like a real sort of experience. Like, ordinarily by now, man, we talk about teams doing very, like, minor levels of tanking to try to get the playoff matchup that they want to, you know, to have in the first round, getting away from a team, getting to a team, or something like that, or teams just kind of playing out the string. You're not seeing that this year. You're not seeing it at the top of the bracket. You're not seeing it at the bottom of the bracket. Like, this seems to have resulted in what people wanted it to be, right? Something that would make the rest of the regular season compelling and interesting. That has happened. Now, of course, you guys don't seem to be that compelled or interested in, like, the season itself, you know, so that's kind of a situation. But as a warm-up act to get you ready for the playoffs, oh, baby, I'm in. I'm here. I want this. But the league gonna have to get their referee situation straight for this, because, man, you can't, you know, the Lakers not in the playoffs just seems like a horrific idea. Like, that's just, you know how wild it would be if it turned out that the first 3 years of the LeBron experience with the Lakers were one championship and two times that they missed the playoffs? Like, that could be a thing. And, oh, by the way, it's not a guarantee that the Lakers are going to be on the outside of this one. If the Lakers jump it up over Portland, because Portland is one game ahead of them right now, if Portland wound up in that seven, then you got Stephen Dame gunning for a chance to get into the playoffs. A far, far, far less likely scenario is the Mavericks dropping down and getting into that place. Like, I'm telling you, we have so many things that might happen in the course of this, and I'm here for it. I am 100% here for it. Good for you, NBA. I thought this was 100% clown stuff to begin with, and they have totally brought me around on what this is going to be. Tangentially related, just because while we're here talking about the NBA, did y'all see Jimmy Butler punk Karl Towns? I don't know if y'all saw this, right? Now, I understand this, man. Karl Towns has had a really long year. It's been really tough for him. It's a lot of things. I wish that dude the best. That don't mean it's okay for you to get punked, and that don't mean that people should not be out here trying to punk you under the circumstances. In fact, somebody can make an argument that given this long year, Karl Towns should have demonstrated a steely resolve that would make him impervious to such things. Jimmy Butler hates that dude's guts. There's no, and the thing you got to understand about it is, it's not like Jimmy just didn't like playing with him, or Jimmy just thought that he got on his nerves, or Jimmy thought that he was an underachiever. Jimmy don't like what he stand for. Like, at the fundamental core of who Karl Towns is, Jimmy Butler does not like that. But what I thought was interesting, and I don't know if anybody saw this, but in the post-game press conference, somebody asked Karl Towns about it, and apparently Karl and Anthony Edwards, my new favorite player of all time, like, they did one of the press conferences together, and somebody asked Towns about it, and Anthony Edwards jumped in and took the question, all right? Jumped in and took the question. And let me make sure I get this quote for you directly. So Anthony Edwards jumps in and says, man, they grown men, dog. They just be talking, having a regular conversation, if you ask me. It's no competition if we not talking shit to each other. But what I found so fascinating about this is Anthony Edwards has already recognized Karl ain't built for this. Right? That dude is 19 years old, looked over there and was like, nah, he can't handle this. I'm gonna have to do this for him. Like, that is something that Karl Towns in year six should be doing for Anthony Edwards. Instead, Anthony Edwards got some wisdom, some street, whatever it is, to look over and be like, nah, I gotta do this for you. Translation, wow, Jimmy Butler really punked him. Like, really, really, really did punk him. 100%. It is everything in that moment. Why I am already in love with Anthony Edwards and why I'm just not here for Karl Towns. All right, man. So you guys been hearing about NIL stuff for a while around the discussion of compensating college athletes. And for those of you who have been seeing people talk about NIL but don't know what it means, I know you out there and it's okay because you ain't want to ask. I've been down that road before. NIL, name, image, and likeness. And so it's the idea that players should be able to profit off of their names, their images, and their likenesses in a way that is currently prohibited by the NCAA. Now, I have always had a problem with the framing of the name, image, and likeness thing because I think it's a cop-out. Not that I don't think that players should be able to profit off of their name, image, and likenesses. Like, I don't want to pretend that. But the cop-out to me is, the school should be paying them, right? Like, this idea that the schools are not responsible, even though they wind up profiting, just really bothers me. And so what you wind up with is all kinds of people that are trying to find ways to maintain the status quo while also recognizing that it's preposterous that the players are not compensated with some actual legal tender, okay? So rather than saying it is wrong that these schools do not pay them, they're like, well, they should be able to go make some side money, even though we all fully understand they don't have time to do much of anything. Like, when exactly are they supposed to get this time to make this money based off their name, image, and likeness? When are they supposed to have the time to go do the photo shoots or whatever that's going to come along with it, right? They don't have time for that because they're too busy out here getting daddy's money for the NCAA. Right. So, yeah, they should be able to profit off their name, their image, their likeness, all of that stuff. But I don't see that as being nearly as positive as other people do. Now, there have been some provisions in some bills. Like, I think there's a federal bill, I think Chris Murphy of Connecticut put there, that had a key component, which is that it would also allow the players to collectively bargain in use of their name, image, and likeness, which I think is important because they got to hire somebody else to do this. And again, this is the thing that worries me about this is, they're going to need help to find opportunities. They're going to need help to go through contracts and make sure they don't get conned in the name of these opportunities, everything else. Because in the end, we still talk about people 18 to 22. Like, this is ripe for a level of corruption. When the schools are like, yo, we need to run these, you know, somebody needs to run these deals by us so we can check them out for them. There's something to that. Like, if they're not going to be allowed to have agents, like, I don't negotiate any of this stuff by myself. I'm 40 years old with two master's degrees in economics. I don't do that. Like, you need somebody that's going to be able to help you out in this space. And so, yeah, every time I look at a name, image, and likeness thing, I'm like, nah, this isn't it, man. These schools are making all this money, and they keep making all this money. And the money that they pay to these coaches keeps going up and up. But they always swear they ain't got no money. They always do. Like, you know what it what it really is, how they play with the players. And you guys have seen this kind of thing happen before. You know that person that owes you like $20-something, $25, $30 or whatever it is, and they swear they ain't got your $30, but they always got the weed man's $30. You know what I mean? You stay broke, but you stay high. Like, I don't really understand how it is that that goes. You know, like, it's cool. Like, yeah, thanks for offering me some. Like, I appreciate that, but I thought it was that you was broke, right? And that's what it feels like to me with the NCAA. It's always, oh, we ain't got the money. But didn't you just get a new car? Yeah, oh, yeah, man. But, you know, I ain't really got the money. Like, that's the game they always wind up playing. Everybody else always getting paid, and they ain't got no money for the people that's on the ground doing it for them. Right? They don't. And so if you want to know in part where I get so worried about this name, image, and likeness stuff and why I feel like it's all a con, the state of Georgia just signed a bill that would allow for players to profit off their name, image, and likeness. Now, one of the things that becomes interesting about this to me is that not paying players is kind of a pillar of conservative politics. Like, I don't know if I want to say a pillar necessarily, but they have found throughout time that I forget which professor it was at the University of Massachusetts, had found that strong correlating factor, I think he said the strongest correlating factor to the opposition to paying players is an opposition to the expansion of civil rights. Like, this is fundamentally a race issue when it comes down to it. But where are the states that got on board as quickly as possible to pass legislation about name, image, and likeness? They all in the SEC. Like, it all became a matter of competition. The capitalism came into play. And they're like, okay, well, we need to have one so we can tell our players, you know, tell players when they come here that this is something they're going to be able to do, because everybody needed to hit the ground running for what the game was going to be, right? When the cartel could figure out how to block it out altogether, they didn't have to think about it. Why did the cartel have to block it out altogether? Because they knew damn well once it became possible, schools themselves were actually going to get on it by some measure, because they felt some measure of force by the external circumstances. All right. So Georgia is one state that has passed this, and their interesting governor went ahead and signed this name, image, and likeness law. But this is where it gets to be interesting. The law allows schools to take up to 75% of what the players earn off their name, image, and likeness and put that into an escrow account. And then the escrow account pays out, one, after the player graduates, but two, when I said that that money's put into an escrow account, I mean that everybody's money is put into the same escrow account, and that money from that escrow account is then distributed to all the athletes. Now, maybe that is some kind of like Title IX situation, right? Like, maybe that's the game that they're playing, but that's not what I hear. What I hear is another example of where these young black kids are going to go out there and earn money and then have to give it to the white folks. That's what I see. That's how I see this thing ultimately playing out, because they not going to let these black boys and girls get no money without somebody white getting a significant taste off of what they make. I mean, look, the whole basis of the NCAA and how this whole thing is set up, black people go out and make the money for everybody, and then they use that money, and rather than give it to them, they basically build up sports to allow the white kids to have stuff to play. Like, that's what it is. The games that black people play pay for the games that white people play. That's what the whole game is, a redistribution of resources from black people to white people. Like, whether you want to acknowledge this or not, there's been research done on this. It's a wealth transfer, basically. This is how it goes. And so now they are trying to codify into, well, they have codified into law the idea that you can earn this money, but then you got to give the money back to the school, and then this, they're going to hold it, and then they're going to give it to you on the back end. So you know what that means? That means the University of Georgia becomes a bank. But see, this is something that the NCAA does, and people don't realize this, like how much they play banking games. So my man, John Walters, he works for Sports Illustrated. I think he does some stuff for The Athletic now, a few other people. He's teaching at Arizona State right now. And he made this point. I didn't realize this. So with the NCAA tournament, when teams go to the tournament, you get the conference gets money based on how far its teams proceed through the tournament. They call them shares, right? The NCAA pays out the money on those shares over a 6-year period, right? That means the NCAA is a bank. They are holding your money, making interest off your money, and then give you a little bit of it back at a time. And that is what they're talking about doing here. So what Georgia is trying to do with their law, aside from the bank element of it, they want to keep them broke. Like, this is the part that gets me about it is, why can't I have my money right now? Like, why I got to wait? And this came up a lot when people talk about this. Yeah, I'm okay with paying players, but they, you know, should put the money in a trust for after they graduate, because you know they're not going to be responsible with the money. You ain't responsible with your money. If a provision for getting paid was that you had to be responsible with the money, would none of y'all have no money? Nobody would have no money. Part of being grown is you get to be as irresponsible with your money as you want to be. And you can say, well, they're not really grown. You might think they're not really grown, but when they get in trouble, they grown as hell. Ain't none of them getting tried as juveniles when they wind up in court. Nah, they grown-ups then, but when it's time to give them some money, they not grown-ups. What are you talking about? They responsible enough to decide they want to go fight in a damn war, but not responsible enough to get their money back in these times. So again, I look at the name, image, and likeness, and I'm like, one, I just don't know how many players are actually going to be able to make any money off of it. But apparently some of them are going to make money off of it, because that money is then going to be like redistributed. So let's try this, right? Because it's not like these guys are going to be signing $1 million deals or anything like that. So let's say I'm a player and I get like a $10,000 endorsement deal for some local business. And I could be wrong, but that seems like a reasonable sum that somebody could get. And not the best money in the world, but not bad money, given the, you know, given that your room and board is paid for and stuff like that. You know, it's a decent little bit of change, right? So if I get $15,000 for doing whatever, and the school has the right to take 75% of that money. Okay, so now all I get is like $3,800. It's right around there. I get $3,800. The rest of this, which is like 11 G's, give or take, is then distributed to all the rest of the athletes. Ain't nobody getting no money. Like this 85 scholarship players on the football team by itself. Ain't nobody getting, if you do that, nobody gets any money. And that takes us back to what the point is in the end. Keeping them broke. That's at every turn, these folks want to keep them broke. And that to me is why it is important that the discussion of this never leave from the immorality of the idea that these schools make all this money and then don't have to share any of it. It's not simply a problem that the players don't get paid. It's that the profits that they generate directly, they don't have a share of. And that's a very specific thing that has to be dealt with and needs to be discussed much more clearly, that specific relationship is at play. And then you see a law put in that then says, okay, you can get a little money, but then we go wind up taking the rest, which tells you what all of this fundamentally comes back to: keeping them broke, maintaining that level of control. So yeah, name, image, and likeness. Okay. If you are okay with them getting paid off that, but not okay with them getting paid a salary, you don't have to explain to me why. Explain to yourself why. And while you try to do that, you're probably going to realize that you're full of it. I mean, if you try to explain it to me, you are immediately going to know that you are full of it. But you don't even need me to be the video game boss at this one, baby. You're going to be able to figure it out yourself. Like, yo, this is kind of ridiculous when it comes down to it. You're damn right it's kind of ridiculous when it comes down to it. Pay what you owe. Stop stealing from kids. Period. The Right Time with Bomani Jones Book Club is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Counseling. Visit BetterHelp.com/Bomani for 10% off your first month of online therapy. All right. It is the Right Time Book Club. We are reading Kane Mutiny by Bruce Feldman, a look at the Miami Hurricanes football dynasty. We talked to Spencer Hall about this in the first installment. We talked to Alonzo Highsmith of the Miami Hurricanes next. And now joining us live from California, we have Joel from Missouri City, Joel Anderson in the house. What's going on?
I'm glad you had me on. You know what I'm saying? This is our era of football right here. This is what we grew up on. So, I had to be here to talk about the U, you know?
Like I say, and like I told people, man, there's a whole generation of kids that didn't know it used to be kind of wild out here in these college football streets. They have no idea. Like, when we look at back before we was kids, it was all dry and boring. They got to be looking back like, yo, they was wilding.
Oh, man. I mean, I know that we have a scripted part that we're supposed to talk about. But I mean, to the point that you're talking about, that 1991 Cotton Bowl, like anybody, there's not a football game that has happened like that since then. I mean, God, can you believe, first of all, that was 30 years ago now.
Yes.
I mean, just that game just encapsulated so many of the things that everybody said about Miami and the problems with the program. You know what I'm saying?
There has been one game, I think, since then that was like that. And I think that was the game that they played at Berkeley. Miami was, again, the culprit. Wild, but no, so this is the thing that I don't think that people can get. So it goes from Howard Schellenberger to Jimmy Johnson, and that's when you get like Michael Irvin into the fold, along with all these other cats, and they all from Miami. And like, if you ain't really spent a whole lot of time around Miami, I guess like you figured it out now because the Florida dudes are so deep in football, but they different.
Yes.
And it was a whole bunch of them. And then you had a coach who liked the fact that they kicked it like that. And so that was Jimmy Johnson. But then what happened after Jimmy Johnson was they hired Dennis Erickson. And Dennis Erickson, who's a very good head coach, has like a legitimate college football Hall of Fame case as a head coach. But he wasn't in charge. Like, I can't think of any other situation where the players just loudly say, yeah, we told him that we were going to keep our defense, but we would be okay with running his offense. Like, they knew that they were the reason that this was a thing, because they didn't go to Ohio State, which had all this tradition that preceded them. The players knew that everything that was happening was about the players.
Right. It was like either them or Florida State. Maybe kind of OU, but Barry Switzer was sort of the architect of that.
Yeah.
Miami was one of the first programs where the players were the main event, right? Like, you would go there to see them. It wasn't all this like pageantry, the memories that, you know, there was some, you know, head patriarch of the program or anything like that. It was just the guys. It was Jerome Brown. It was Alonzo Highsmith. I mean, just, I'm a little jealous that he didn't go a little bit deeper into that coin toss at OU. I was hoping he was going to talk about Bomani. He said, I'm not scared of you, bitch.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? I'm not scared. Like, that's the same dude that was up there. Well, you know, really it was about work ethic. Y'all kind of thugging out there too, you know?
No. That was at the coin toss. And like, it wasn't like OU was bringing them the same energy.
Right.
You know, like OU was out here like, we know what's up, but like, we're not doing that. And then next thing you know, they end their grills. And I think I mentioned this before, but this is the most amazing stat of that run. From 1985 to 1987, Oklahoma was 33-3. Those three losses were Miami at home, Miami on the road, Miami in a bowl game.
Yeah, man. Oklahoma did not lose like that back then. They were one of the dominant programs, and Miami just punked them. You brought this up in the episode with Alonzo Highsmith. It was like, for Oklahoma to be the white hats in that, in this rivalry, in those
yes.
games. Like, people should read Charles Thompson's autobiography about that time. Charles Thompson was a quarterback at OU, and he is renowned for having been on the cover of Sports Illustrated in an orange jumpsuit
yes.
with his hands handcuffed behind him. For dealing that stuff, you know what I'm saying? So when they played against Miami, they were still seen as sort of like, not the good guys, but they weren't the bad guys in the way that Miami
right.
was.
Right. And of course, the Miami boys loved it. Anytime one of them, something wound up happening, was like, oh, look at that other school with this dude getting locked up for this, that, and the third. But with Erickson, again, it went too far under Erickson. Like, that is the argument. Nothing is funnier to me, though, than the idea that Dennis Erickson and the president told them that at this Cotton Bowl, y'all are going to behave themselves. And then Michael Irvin calls up and says, no, you not.
Right.
And then they just wild out. They don't want to be there. The weather is terrible. First play of the game, Robert Bailey gives somebody a concussion on the opening kickoff.
But, Monty, you know who did it to him, though?
Stan Thomas.
Ran his mouth and said that he called them typical gangsters and said he was
yes.
the Outland Trophy away from Russell, Maryland. And, I mean, maybe Miami beats them 46-3 regardless, but He didn't do them no favors by running his mouth before the game like that.
Yeah, it's like, I was like that black man. Yeah. Like that, like that's the thing. It's like, come on.
You that type?
Yeah, come on, black man. Like right. you really covered down with that. And so after that, they win the 1991 championship. 92, it looks like they're going to win again. And to this day, for me, probably the most shocking college football game I've ever seen, when Alabama just beat the brakes off them in the Sugar Bowl, just destroyed them.
Well, it really eroded a lot of the like invincibility around the program, right? Like that play where George Teague runs down Lamar Thomas.
Yes.
Strips him. And first of all, the play doesn't count. Like that's one
doesn't
thing.
Matter.
It meant something to see Lamar Thomas, a sprint champion, get run down from behind, get the ball stripped from him. And it was just like, oh, wow, somebody can do that to Miami for real?
One thing that happened with Miami periodically, like the end of the 86/87 Fiesta Bowl is an example of this, where you had these moments where you're reminded that they're still like 20-year-olds that are just really obnoxious. And Lamar Thomas on the bench with the towel over his head after getting run down by George Teague, like something that he could never imagine. Because the thing about it, too, is it's not like Miami went out there and took people lightly.
Right.
Like they went out there to punish you every week and they just got beaten. And you're right, that's the end of that run of the program, is right then.
Right. Nobody beat Miami like that in a big game like that and humiliated them. Like, it's one thing to lose. It's another to get humiliated. And in that way, they got humiliated. And it says something about the times that people thought, well, Alabama probably ain't fast enough to keep up with Miami.
But that was absolutely it, because the Florida teams had just revolutionized everything. And the SEC had not fully integrated.
Nah. Like you said, and I think you guys mentioned this a couple of times, like Georgia, Florida, those were not really the schools that were recruiting those brothers out of South Florida or anything like that.
No.
They had not tapped into it in the way that Miami had.
No, they hadn't fully tapped into recruiting the black people that lived around them.
I mean, LSU, another one of those programs that had not quite fully turned all the way over. You know what I'm saying? They did not realize their potential because they didn't recruit everybody like they could have.
Texas never really turned all the way over. It was a bunch of, like, I think that's something that's probably difficult for a lot of people to grasp is, like, now who did turn over pretty quick? Oklahoma, Nebraska. And even Nebraska haven't turned over quick. Spent the 80s getting beat by Florida teams. They spent the 80s and the early 90s getting beat by Florida teams in bowl games. It was like, all right, we're going to have to go get some of those. And so for Miami, now everybody goes and gets their Florida players. And then on top of it, probation comes, right? The Pell Grant scandal comes. They take this thing down brick by brick. And then they bring in Butch Davis.
But they lost 31 scholarships in 3 years. I mean, that's incredible. Like, that's a real blow for a program. I mean, they signed a class with 17 people, and that was one of the bigger classes over that three-year span. You know what I'm saying? Which says something about how bad things have gotten there with Butch Davis running into it.
Yeah, when the NCAA decides that they want to tear your whole thing down, they will tear your whole thing down. They decided with the University of Houston that they wanted to tear that in the whole thing. Like, even if they didn't give you a death penalty like SMU, if they wanted to make a point and they went and made that point with Miami, but the problem was that they could never really fully bet on is it was just so many players in South Florida that Butch Davis went down there and figured out all kinds of scholarship magic tricks. And there were just so many players that you couldn't hold them down for so long.
Right. I mean, he got Santana Moss in on a track scholarship. Santana Moss was technically a football walk-on, got him in on a track scholarship. And you know who Santana Moss is. I mean, that first class, 17 players. Now, remember, this is coming. The probation is coming. Everybody, the program's going downhill. Butch Davis's first class had 17 players. 8 went on to play in the NFL. I mean, what a hit rate that is. That's an unbelievable hit rate. You know what I'm saying? Half of your class plays in the league, for real? But that's just how deep the talent pool is down in South Florida.
Not all these guys, especially with Miami, were those for whom success is preordained. Like, there's like 2-star recruits that come into this and become it. Like, I think Ed Reed was one of those types where nobody even knew nothing about him.
Ed Reed's best other offer, which is amazing to me, was Tulane.
Yes.
That's a testament not only to the fact that not only did South Florida have this great talent pool, but that Butch Davis was unusually gifted at identifying talent and developing it. That's something like, I mean, Howard Schnellenberger and Jimmy Johnson were great coaches and they did a lot with him, but Butch Davis, in terms of like identifying talent and turning it into something else, like that may have, I don't even know that there's a coach at Miami that's ever done it better than he did in that way.
And it takes, I think, a confidence to say, nobody else is offering you. I only have but so many scholarships, and I'm still going to give you one anyway, right? Because I imagine I would second guess myself if it ain't nobody coming to the house but me and Tulane.
Right. Right. Tulane is supposed to recruit against Southern Miss.
Yes.
Maybe Oklahoma State or Memphis or something. Not Miami.
And in fact, in a situation like that, Tulane probably feels good about their chances because they're like, I mean, he's local, right? Because he's from right up the street. But also they're like, well, I mean, he ain't going to play in Miami. Like, you know, if he wants to get on the field, he going to need to come here. And he went all the way to the Hall of Fame.
I mean, again, another one of those guys that sort of typified that second era of Miami dominance, just sort of like, you know, not quite as highly regarded as some of the other recruits, but just a tough ass dude. The guy that I think of that sort of best typifies that era, he didn't play on any championship team, but he was the guy that sort of built the foundation for that was Edgerrin James.
Yes.
You know, and Edgerrin James is just like, I mean, a beast. Actually, Bomani, the first time you saw Edgerrin James in a football game, was it that UCLA game?
I think that's the first time that I like really watched him. Like I probably, because at that time, Miami wasn't good.
Right.
So they weren't appointment television. That to me, that game in 98 against UCLA, where UCLA was going to be headed to the Rose Bowl and playing for a national championship.
Undefeated. Cade McNown, right. Freddie Mitchell, Deshaun Foster. Great team. Right.
But they had a game that was rescheduled by a hurricane that they were supposed to play in September and then wound up being played like the same weekend as the conference championship games. So that is the same year that Kansas State was upset by Nebraska. Same date that Kansas State was upset by Nebraska and Kansas State was looking like they were going to go to the national championship game. Edgerrin James ran for, I believe the number I remember to this day is 313 yards.
I thought it was 299, but you're probably right.
It's one of the two. It's one of the two.
It was just pitch left, pitch right. You know what I'm saying? It's like student body left, student body right. Like there was not a lot of art to what Edgerrin James was doing. He just murked them dude.
It was 299. You are correct. It was 299. And he, see, Edgerrin James to me was the middle ground, right? Mm-hmm. Of where the program was and where the program wanted to be. Because they were trying to get away from what it was before. Because Butch Davis was a guy that, even though he was there for a lot of it, you know, I get the feeling that like all the dance and the stuff. Like, again, he was there with Jimmy.
Right.
Jimmy ran a different ship than Dennis Erickson ran. And Erickson, they needed to rein that back in. I think that's a fair point at that point. The power dynamic had gone too far to the 20-year-olds.
So people should also read the Broken Beyond Repair story in Sports Illustrated where they called for Miami to drop the football program because I was being kind of like, they were kind of being racist about Miami, man. Miami was, you know, it wasn't that bad. But then you read that article and you're like, oh, wait, okay. Like they actually had a lot of stuff going on. In addition to the Pell Grant scandal, they had sexual assault scandal. There's all sort of stuff going on in the program that was, I mean, beyond the pale for a program, right?
Yeah. And even if we weren't talking about like the absolutely serious stuff, even some of the on-field stuff was just kind of like, nah, man, it's clear that nobody's in charge here. And so Butch Davis was the guy who was in charge. And so Dan Lebertard always tell me that the guys that came in that Butch wave took a certain pride in not being the previous Canes. No judgment at the previous Canes, but not being them. But Edgerrin James, he was what the old Canes would have looked like if they were 1998, right? The dreads, the fronts, and he was just all day long Miami. This is a man who once said in an interview, okay, that after he tore his ACL in the league, that he worked out at 4 o'clock in the morning and crackhead spotted him. And people were like, crackheads? He's like, yeah, who else is up at 4 o'clock in the morning? And he said that he would pay him, I think it was $10 to spot him. And he's like, $10 don't sound like a lot to you, but to a fiend, that's a hit and a hot meal. like, this is who this man is with shame whatsoever.
I mean, one of the first out of Muck City, you know what I'm saying? Yes. I mean, yeah, I mean, he was just a different kind of dude. And I mean, he really represents with that new era of Miami. It was just a dude with a lot of personality, a lot of toughness, but also just, you know, like he didn't do a lot of the stuff that Melvin Bratton and them were doing. You know, he wasn't going to be up at the coin toss calling somebody a basic.
No, but they were the same dudes. They were different dudes, but they were the same dudes, right? And so now Edgerrin James leaves in 98. That 99 team was one that probably could have been better, but ultimately proved to be a bit disappointing. And then comes 2000, right? When they probably were robbed of a chance to play for a national championship because they beat Florida State and Florida State wound up making the bowl game because the math on the BCS at that time was real messed up.
Right. They played against that OU team that had Roy Williams, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. And it had Josh Heupel.
Josh Heupel, 13-2. Was that the final?
It was 13-2. And don't forget, it was the Orange Bowl. So it would have been Miami playing in Miami against Oklahoma again.
Right. And I mean, that Miami team, if I'm not mistaken, was that the team with James Jackson, Clinton Portis, Clinton Portis was the backup running back, man.
Yes, it was sophomore Clinton Portis. That team had Dan Morgan. Like, basically, the biggest difference between the 2000 team and the 2001 team that's the all-time great is that the 2000 team had Dan Morgan.
Right.
But the next team had that crazy freshman class with Sean Taylor and Kellen Winslow. I think Antrell Roll came in that same year.
Yeah.
What are we talking about here, bro? Like, do you hear what I just said?
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, Kellen Winslow didn't even really play. I mean, like, he had to wait in line.
Because Shockey was there.
Yeah, Shockey was there. Right. I mean, that's how deep that tight end room was. You know what I'm saying? How deep the running back room was. They said that actually that when Willis McGahee got there, that essentially Clinton Portis pumped him, that he got in his head. And Willis McGahee, 6 foot 1, 225 pound, 4'3" running Willis McGahee, who was a Heisman Trophy finalist and one of the best college running backs I've ever seen when he was healthy, he let Clinton Portis get in his head. But that's just how deep the competition was at the school back then.
The three deep at running back in 2001 was Clinton Portis, who like has a sneaky good Hall of Fame case if you really want to look at it, right? Clinton Portis was one. Frank Gore was two. Willis McGahee was three.
Right.
The following year, Willis McGahee scored like 26 touchdowns after Frank Gore got hurt.
Right. Also, don't forget, Najee Davenport was in that running back.
At fullback. At fullback.
Yeah.
At fullback. Yeah, he was just out there to block with Andre Johnson playing at wide receiver because they had just lost Santana Moss. Reggie Wayne had been there a couple of years before. No, Reggie Wayne was on that 2000 team, I think.
He was. And, oh, man, look, DJ Williams was in that running back room as well, too. Remember, DJ yes. Williams started out at fullback, and then they finally were like, look, man, go ahead and play linebacker. Plays linebacker. Yeah. A few years later, he's a first-round draft pick.
Number one recruit in America. Yeah, like, when they brought him in. No, it just got so loaded that in 2001, they didn't have a coach. Larry Coger, I mean, he made sure everybody got there on time and stuff. You know what I'm saying? I could have coached that team to a championship.
Well, here's the thing. I think that like Bruce Feldman tries to give Larry Coker a lot more credit, right, than most people traditionally give him. The best thing you can say about Larry Coker is he didn't screw it up, at least initially.
Yes.
He had the talent. He inherited it. He kept them in line so that they could be the best team that they ever were. But, Larry Coker, we saw what happened. And then he started the program at UTSA. And, I mean, that didn't work either, you know?
Yeah. Well, here's something I want to ask you about Butch Davis. What do you think about this? Mm. Has anybody cared less about legacy than Butch Davis? And I ask that because all he needed to do was stick around for another couple of years, and he's stacking up national championships. Had a money dispute, wound up going to coach the Cleveland Browns, because this always happened with Miami too. They didn't want to pay coaches. Like, these coaches all wound up leaving. Now, Erickson's a little bit of a different situation because it probably just needed to be over in that case, but they always wound up in a money place with whatever the coach was. And they were like, we don't care. We got the players. Like, we got what we need, because they never invested in football at Miami. They just had players. But if Butch had stayed, given how 2000 went, they win in 2001.
Right. Absolutely.
They probably win in 2002.
For sure.
They almost did it with Coker.
Right.
They keep bringing in players. It just keeps going and going. I have no idea what it all looks like now if Butch Davis had just stuck around for a couple of more years.
Oh, the thing, he really gets forgotten because without that championship. I mean, and like, I'd forgotten that he was still actually coaching college football right now. He's at Florida International. But yeah, if he had just stayed one extra year, an extra 2 years, then we're talking about a guy, we're talking about him in the same tone that we talk maybe Howard Schnellenberger. It wasn't necessarily any less of a rebuilding job than Howard Schnellenberger had. Like, Schnellenberger built something from nothing. Like, there's not fertile ground there. And so Butch Davis did have that advantage. But the way that they tore down that Miami program, like, I mean, nobody else has done what Butch Davis has done since he left. I mean, which is a credit to him and his ability to, again, identify and develop talent. And there's just not a lot of people that are good like that. So, if he had stayed and won, I think we at least remember him in the way that we remember Howard Schnellenberger.
Right. And one interesting thing before we go, we hadn't really gotten to this. I always say this about Miami. They had increased the level of blackness in college football. But even they, at quarterback, took a long time before the revolution got to that place in the game.
So DeCoy Harris was kind of one of the first ones, right, I think of?
Like Ryan Collins, was there in the mid 90s. But DeCoy Harris is the first starting black quarterback that I can think of at Miami. And that's 2008, I think, is when he gets there.
Right. They didn't have a black quarterback for the most part, other than Ryan Collins, who was solid.
He was there.
I guess. He was solid. Right. But yeah, the first guy that they really like built the program around, like, he was like the leader of the team and one of the faces of the program. And I mean, but that's just, you know, how they built the problem. I mean, yeah, man, Howard Schnellenberger came up under Bear Bryant, and that's just kind of the way things were. And I mean, that I don't want to put too much on Miami about that because a lot of programs are like that. You've pointed out USC, Georgia.
But the thing is, I was wondering that pro-style offense became the cop-out, right? Because, you know, because Bryant did have black quarterback in his time because he was out there running the bones at some point, you know, like... I mean, hell, Darryl Royal messed around and got one. You know, he was cold as hell, you know, because that was the only way it was going to happen. But, like, he messed around and got one. But that I do think this, that if you had decided that you were going to run a drop-back pro-style offense, any place that was running a high school offense that would develop somebody to do such a thing was not going to have a black quarterback.
Right. Well, I mean, nobody, you know, the availability of the training and all that sort of stuff and the 707 camps, that didn't really become a part of the foundation of high school football until maybe a decade later. So, I mean, a lot of the guys that, you know, we're talking about, the dual threat quarterbacks, whatever, they didn't get an opportunity to, you know, do that sort of passing, complex passing offenses until much later. They didn't get access to that sort of stuff. But I actually got something for you here. You know who was scheduled to go to Miami and initially was going to go to Miami, but they convinced him to go somewhere else. And I would have loved to have seen how it would have worked out.
Who's that?
Vince Young. You know, Vince Young was initially thought to have been going to Miami early. And they talked him out of it, but Miami was in the lead for him. Because remember, this is like 2001, 2002. I'm trying to
2002 was his recruiting year.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is Miami still at or near its peak. And so, of course, Miami was at play for him. And Vince Young would have, you know, culturally would have fit probably pretty well, but he didn't go.
They would have had to overhaul the offense for him. And I'm wondering if they would have been willing to do that.
Right. Well, also, like, do you think he would have reached his full potential in Miami? I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's my thing. Unless they were going to overhaul the offense, if they were going to keep running the offense that they had run before, then it wasn't going to work. But if they were going to do something like, I mean, Mac had to eventually overhaul his offense.
Well, I was going to say, Texas had to overhaul that offense too, because that ain't the same offense that Chris Sims was running or Major Applewhite was running.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. But that's just what the question comes down to. How willing were you? Because Texas did not have a style of offense that was synonymous with the culture of the program, and Miami did.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because that was their selling point for the longest, is we're going to run a pro-style offense. Now what a pro-style offense is totally a different idea than it used to be.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot more creativity in it. It allows for the usage of a lot more people in these RPOs. And everybody acknowledges now what they didn't used to acknowledge is that it's okay if your quarterback can get himself out of danger. You know what I'm saying? Like, you want that guy to be able to escape hits. And occasionally it helps if that guy can move a little bit. And sometimes those guys disproportionately tend to be black.
Yes, there it is. Joel Anderson. Check him out at Slate. Always appreciate it. Joel from Missouri City.
Yeah, man, I like being here. Oh, real quick, I just had to say this. I loved Miami so much that I didn't even hold what they did to my Cougars against them in 1991. That's how much I loved Miami as a kid. So
yeah, that was the thing. Houston thought they were still going to be good by then. Nah. And they went down there and got their asses kicked.
Yeah, I argue that they got them bumped out of the Big 12, that loss was irrevocable.
Nah, you know what was going to keep them out of the Big 12, and the answer is Texas.
Yeah, well, that's a...
If Houston wound up in the Big 12 tomorrow, it would change the landscape of college football.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Which is why I don't have a problem starting off talking about what the Canes did to your Horns. So.
Yeah, I totally understand. Fair. You know, not like Miami would ever even bother to play TCU.
Okay.
They don't even know what they've never even heard of it.
Well, hey, just thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it.
Appreciate that, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing three times a week. Gabe Bassett and Tony Collette, you to handle things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.